Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to a program dealing with the major health issues of our day. For those of you who have had the time to examine what is happening on the area of health freedom, this particular hour will focus on the Codex Alimentarius with a new program that brings you up to date. Now, for the past year, we have, I guess, done about a total of 15 hours of broadcasting on why we're concerned with what is called Codex, C-O-D-E-X. Unfortunately, most Americans are not. They simply don't see an issue there. In fact, recently in Baltimore, I spoke with one of the heads of the National Nutritional Food Association that supposedly represents the interest of the health food industry. And I asked, what do you feel is the issue involving Codex? And he said, there is no issue. I said, well, what about harmonization? Those countries throughout the world who right now have highly restrictive programs when it comes to being able to take your supplements. I gave examples of Australia, Germany, France, Norway, where if you went into a health food store and say, I'm suffering from, let's say, some short-term memory loss, and I would like to take phosphatidylcholine at 500 milligrams, they say, well, we can't sell it. I'm trying to help my prostate by taking some zinc at 30 milligrams. You couldn't buy it. In fact, most of the supplements that you take for granted, that you can buy any day of the week, in many countries, you simply cannot get them. They're not available. Or if you can, it's by such low potency that there's virtually no therapeutic benefit, let alone really preventative benefit. Their idea is that if they've never been made available, then there's no need for them. The National Academy of Sciences has taken it upon itself to determine that there is an upper limit to all supplements, going beyond which you could pose a potential danger, and therefore we should start capping the amount of vitamins and minerals and herbs that we're allowed to take. If you contact the National Poison Control Center and ask them, over the past 20 years, how many people have died by taking herbs, vitamins, minerals, amino acid supplements, they would have to look long and hard to find a single death from any mineral, none from amino acids, only a few ever from any special supplement, including tryptophan, when a genetically altered form by Shenandoah, the company making it, came out with it. But for almost 20 years, there were no deaths. And where the deaths were, at over 100,000 a year is from pharmaceutical drugs, hundreds a year from over-the-counter prescription drugs. In fact, give you an idea, just one form of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory for arthritis, just last year, caused 16,600 deaths. Now, that's according to the New England Journal of Medicine. Is there an effort to restrict us from being able to take any of these over-the-counter medications or prescription medications? No. Is there any major effort to corner the market on drugs? No. On vitamins, herbs? Yes. Why? In part because if you're taking Proscar for your enlarged prostate, then you're not going to be taking stinging nettles or Africanum pygium or lycopene. But if you're taking lycopene, stinging nettles, and Africanum pygium, all non-toxic, all natural, and just as effective, according to the studies, as Proscar, then you're going to be spending a lot less money and not having the side effects, but also there will not be the revenue stream to the pharmaceutical industry. How is it that the vast majority of vitamin manufacturers, whose very self-interest should be to examine these issues as carefully and with as much scholarship as possible, have not done so? How is it that the average American is completely oblivious that this issue even exists? We're going to discuss that in this particular hour. And we're going to do that by speaking with John Hamill. John Hamill is the president of the International Advocates for Health Freedom. He's been monitoring Codex closely since 1996 and has attended several Codex meetings and an anti-Codex demonstration in Germany. And through his presentation, we will see what the problem is currently after hearings by Congressman Burton on an oversight on the Codex, what our rights are, and what we should do about it. And again, for everyone who's interested in health freedom, I hope that you listen through this hour. You certainly are going to have a lot of facts you did not know before. Let's go to John Hamill. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you.
John, if you were to contact even Legislator Burton's office, who has been in the past favorably disposed to freedom of choice, or many other legislators, they would tell you it's a non-issue. That A, you're being paranoid. B, that you're reactionary, and that you in particular have an incendiary personality. You attack. You alienate everyone. So this has nothing to do with reality. We have laws in the United States that protect us, if not just today, but in the future. And these have been codified by House, Senate, signed by the President, and they're not going to be overturned or altered or abridged or amended by anything that's happening in any other country of the world. We are a sovereign nation. And that this is really just about one man who seems to have nothing to do except to spend his entire life writing harassing letters or making himself a pain in the side of everyone. That was the statement given to me by one of the heads of the National Nutritional Food Association. I'm, of course, quoting as best I can remember. I would like for you to respond on all issues, first explaining what the issue is by itself. Secondly, the response that you've received from the legislators, what the hearings showed us, and I'd like to do it with as much detail as possible, so people can understand for themselves.
Okay. Not sure exactly where you want me to start. Should I start with a brief description of what the Codex problem is?
Yes.
Okay. The United Nations has a body called the Codex Alimentarius Commission. Codex Alimentarius in Latin means code of law for food. The Codex Commission is developing international standards for the purpose of facilitating the greater sale of food products by harmonizing the laws involving their sale so that a company selling a food product won't have to comply with innumerable sets of laws from different countries but only has to comply with Codex standards to sell his product all over the world. The Codex Commission has a lot of different committees. The committee that addresses vitamins and minerals is the Codex Committee on Nutrition and Foods for Special Dietary Use. The host country that hosts the meetings of that committee is Germany, the world's largest exporter of pharmaceutical drugs. By hosting that committee, the Germans are attempting to get the rest of the world to harmonize to their very restrictive laws governing dietary supplements. We've got a situation here where the United States, through both NAFTA and the WTO, have entered into a constant state of harmonizing our regulatory requirements. As specified in the FDA Modernization Act of 1997. This is a quote here from that law. The agency, that is the FDA, will move toward the acceptance of mutual recognition agreements relating to the regulation of good manufacturing practices between the EU and the USA. And under the FDA Modernization Act, the agency will regularly participate in meetings with representatives of other foreign governments to discuss and reach agreements on methods and approaches to harmonize regulatory requirements. That's Public Law 105-115-410(c)(2) and (3), 21 U.S.C. 383(c)(2) and (3). So on a basis of that, the FDA is engaging in actions intended to harmonize all their regulations, including their regulations for dietary supplements, to an international standard that is currently under development. This international standard is a most definite threat to be quite restrictive. Although it hasn't been finalized yet, it's not hard to see the direction it's going in, because in the European Union, all 15 European Union nations are being threatened with harmonization to something called the EU Vitamin Directive, which is pretty much identical to the German Codex Vitamin proposal. This Vitamin Directive has been voted on by the European Parliament. It has passed through the European Parliament. They totally ignored thousands of signatures from vitamin consumers all over the world, including many from the EU nations. There is an online petition which anyone can look at www.laleva.cc, where you can find that international petition against Codex and against the EU Vitamin Directive. The EU Parliament ignored it, and now that matter is being taken up next by the EU Council of Ministers. This EU Council of Ministers is not an elected body. It's an appointed body. They typically totally ignore the citizens of those 15 EU countries. And they are indeed the lawmaking body, while the European Parliament is there pretty much just for window dressing. So we have a rather ridiculous situation going on here, where the next meeting of the Codex Committee on Nutrition and Foods for Special Dietary Use is coming up in November. Prior to that time, unless some miracle occurs and all of a sudden this EU Council of Ministers actually begins listening to the will of the people that live in those countries, which I would not anticipate they're doing, all 15 EU nations are going to be voting as a block behind Germany. The United States only has one vote in this Codex process. No consideration whatsoever is given to the fact that we have a very large population under this UN system, which radically goes against our entire system of representative government. Even a tiny little country like Norway, with its very small population of only 4 million people, has as much voting power as the United States. Therefore, we can be handily outvoted in this Codex process, and they can push, the pharma cartel can easily push their agenda through to completion. Now, I find it quite ironic that several or at least two of these witnesses that Congressman Burton had testify at his hearing, where he excluded grassroots witnesses who could have brought out the truth. Two of his witnesses, Lauren Israelson, who is the executive director of the Utah Natural Products Alliance, and David Seckman, who is the executive director of National Nutritional Foods Association, just 10 days after Burton's hearing, they flew over to Cape Town, South Africa, where they participated in a conference titled towards a global regulatory model. In other words, while simultaneously denying that Codex is an issue and that our domestic laws are in any way threatened, simultaneous to saying that and lying to their memberships, they are going over to South Africa, which takes the better part of a day on a plane just to fly there, and they're engaging in a conference that is intended to develop a model that very well may compromise U.S. domestic law. So these people are lying. The one individual from NNFA, Carl Riedel, the co-chair of their international committee, who presented the testimony specifically on the Codex issue, lied under oath as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, John, this program is not going to drop itself into name-calling. You can't do that.
Okay, I won't do that.
And do not do that, because that's one of the things that's gotten you one of the worst reputations in this country when it comes to these issues. Deal with facts, friend. Just facts.
Okay?
Because let me tell you something. Do you think I would tolerate someone coming on here saying that John Hamill's a paranoid, delusional psychotic?
I'll deal with facts, Gary.
Just facts. Nobody cares about what you believe when it comes to their motives. We can't prove motives, John. And all that happens here when you start alleging that someone's a liar is that you then, it's you against the world, David against Goliath. All we care about are facts. Tell us what you know that you can prove that has been proven, that has documentation to support it. Let us decide then, give us the benefit of being intelligent enough that we do not have to be spoon-fed any of this, that if we decide by looking at facts that someone has misstated the truth, that someone has gone over that line between representing what we consider the public interest and representing special interest group interest, that we will then find that that person no longer will hold our trust and or therefore may challenge us to take some action within the court system or within the legislative system or letter writing, some passive and nonviolent approach to these. Otherwise, it just becomes another name calling. And I've never allowed that on my program. This is not a blood sport program. All right. Are we clear on that?
I'll quote from Carl Riedel. He stated the following. The Food and Drug Administration Modernization Act of 1997 provides specific exemptions to international agreements for dietary supplements. And he cites the Public Law 105-115, Section 410/21 U.S.C. 383. Okay, the fact of the matter is, I spearheaded the campaign on Capitol Hill that did get an amendment to that law. The purpose of the amendment was indeed to exempt dietary supplements and protect dietary supplements. The fact is, however, I sent a letter to the FDA, which was responded to by L. Robert Lake, who is the director of the Office of Regulatory Affairs at CIFSAN at FDA. And he responded to my question of why wasn't the FDA obeying the law? Why weren't they paying attention to that amendment that I worked so hard to get, the one that Carl cited in his testimony? And his response to me was that based on prior agreements, that is, through the mutual recognition agreements signed under NAFTA and GATT, the FDA is obligated to engage in a constant process of harmonization. And it even says that in a different part of that very same law, the FDA Modernization Act of 1997, and I quoted from that section previously. And so he is ignoring that one section that was intended to protect dietary supplements because he feels that they're legally allowed to. He also feels that based on how it was actually worded, he feels that they don't have to pay attention to it because he feels it doesn't specifically tell them not to engage in harmonization involving dietary supplements. He feels it merely gives them the option not to if they choose not to.
Okay, so but focus on this for a moment. Here you have people who have different interpretations, different readings on legislative actions or mandates or laws or oversights. There's a difference between people sharing different opinions about what something means versus ascribing a character judgment. When you say that someone lied or is a liar, by extension, it is that that person is not capable of being or should not be trusted, and therefore the likelihood of trusting him on anything there is diminished or eliminated altogether. So I like to see what the differences are and then decide which, if any, of these opinions I would hold for myself as being more accurate. There's a difference between talking about your interpretation versus someone else's interpretation. Otherwise, everything that disagrees with your interpretation then becomes susceptible of being challenged as a lie, and therefore the person is the liar, and therefore the hidden agenda. And not everyone who disagrees with you, John, is a liar. Would you agree with that?
Okay, I would agree with that. However, let me explain something. I faxed Carl Riedel the following prior to the hearing. I faxed him the statement made by L. Robert Lake with his interpretation, where it clearly showed the FDA absolutely intends to totally ignore that amendment which Carl claims is protecting us. I wish it were protecting us, but I have tangible proof that the FDA thinks they can ignore it. And that should have been brought out under oversight. It really it still should be. It's still something that Congress absolutely must look at, and the reason they must look at it is because of a letter that was signed by Dan Burton and four other members of Congress in 1998, specifically standing on a basis of that amendment. They used that amendment as their legal basis for telling the FDA not to put a pharmaceutically funded, unscientific, heavily biased paper on the table at Codex titled A Risk Assessment Model for Establishing Safe Upper Levels for Nutrients. And anyone on your listening to your show can go to my website and see a GIF file of that letter with Congressman Burton's signature on it. It can be viewed at www.iahf.com in the section called Letters from Congress. Now, the fact is, also on my website in the media section, there is video footage of Dr. Beth Yetley from the FDA and the only person on our American Codex delegation with the power to either speak or vote. I have videotape of her literally ignoring the letter from Congress. And so that is something I think that should have been looked at very carefully in the oversight hearing. Now, to Congressman Burton's credit, to his absolute credit, he did state both in his oral and written testimony an intention to ask the Congressional Research Service at the Library of Congress to look very carefully at this entire issue and to ask them to clarify things. I just wish he had asked them to do that prior to holding a hearing, because I think it would have helped him at the hearing. It also might have helped his choice of witnesses, because, as I stated previously, two of his witnesses, immediately after the hearing was ended, went over to South Africa to work on developing a global regulatory model.
Okay, now let's look at this from a little different point of view for a moment. I had an opportunity to speak with some of the people who were also seeking to make presentations, as well as someone from Burton's office. Burton is very concerned about protecting our freedom of choice, according to the sources, and that you have one or two ways of approaching a person. And this doesn't deal with laws. It deals with rules of etiquette, rules of conduct. If someone were to write me a demeaning letter, which they have, saying that I must get involved in the Pacifica a situation publicly and denounce this group and denounce that group and ask for the removal of this person and reinstatement of that person. And if I don't do so, then I'm a traitor or betraying all the efforts of everyone else. I don't respond to that as if I'm obligated to do what someone wants me to do. That's their agenda. They have a right to that agenda. I go about things in a different way. I try to use as much of a emotionally neutral way of looking at things. I'll do my own research. I'll try to seek out the facts as I know them. And to the degree I am capable or anyone's willing to listen to me, I will try to work quietly on healing wounds, making positive changes, protecting the integrity of the station from the efforts of anyone who would sell it or eviscerate its programming or its philosophy. I have seen by being in major efforts, the anti-war effort, the feminist effort, the environmental effort, the human rights effort, I've been in all these my entire adult life. There's a difference between respecting the wishes of individuals, many of whom, by the way, are extremely self-serving from all sides and all points of view, versus the people who are simply trying to make things better. We don't all grandstand. We don't all need to beat our chests and say, look at me, right's on my side. Some people do. My methods have always been, look at the facts first, not the rhetoric. And then, what can you do to make a bad situation better? There are people working on this effort, some more quietly than others. In the case of Burton, people on his staff have been verbally assaulted, accused, denigrated, challenged, attacked by you. And then, by extension, by other people that you have gotten so excited on this issue that when they contact the legislator's office, they don't say, would you please examine this or would you at least clarify this? They start accusing these people of being part of, in a pocket of the pharmaceutical industry, and that these people are selling us out and they're traitors. And you start using that kind of incendiary language with some of these people, they won't necessarily stay objective. They won't stay neutral on the emotions and look for the truth. They can then decide, well, I'm not going to be dealt this way. I don't need someone denigrating me and then demanding that I do what they want to do, how they want it done, who they will not. You're dealing with human beings. It's like talking with two scientists on an issue that either one could have an objective opinion about, and by the way they approach it and each other, suddenly there's no objectivity. Instead, there is people working on a more base element, not because they've sold out, but because they've in some way felt threatened. It's amazing what happens to even astute and well-meaning people when they feel threatened. And I use this when I received a call the other day, and I'm not in New York now, I'm on the road, and a simple reason, there's an awful lot of issues that have to be dealt with. And no one, we don't have 10,000 people working to help a woman get her kids back, or helping to stop fluoridation in a small community, or helping to protect the right of a physician to practice medicine, help their patients when the state is taking away their license, and also trying to get a piece of legislation passed in the state to act as the basis for challenging informed consent, so that in every state then a person can be protected by saying, no, I don't want to take electroconvulsive therapy, and no, you can't give it to me. And right now, John Henry Thomas, a political dissident from Haiti, has received over 60 electroconvulsive therapies, and there has just been one or two people, that's it, and they didn't have any power. They didn't have power within the media. They didn't have power within the legal community. They just got on their, you know, internets and started telling people. Had they not done that, we wouldn't have known that John Henry Thomas even existed. Now we do. Now he's a part of the cause, and we are taking on the issues. How did I take it on that issue, John? not by yelling and screaming at the state or writing threatening letters and to the Commissioner of Mental Health of New York State, where he's held in Pelham State Hospital, or to the other individual who is also part of this whole issue, and that is an individual, Adam Czyzko, S-C-Y-S-Z-K-O. He's a 25-year-old Polish immigrant who's been held against his will at Pelham State Psychiatric Center for over 5 months, and he is appealing a court order authorizing Pelham to involuntarily administer up to 20 electroconvulsive shocks, and they've already shocked him twice before a stay was obtained by his attorney, Kim Madaro of Mental Hygiene Legal Services. And so you look around and you see all kinds of issues, and they're all legitimate. And you have to decide which ones are most important. There's only so much time and energy we can devote to any single issue. There are far more problems than there are people trying to solve them. And these problems are frequently the ones that have been created by the special interest groups. Just like Kodak, it's a legitimate issue, and I believe created by the pharmaceutical cartels to, in effect, eliminate vitamins from being sold as they are now, so they can charge outrageous amounts of money for the raw materials and sell small quantities, low potencies, at the same high prices now. And they've already shown their proclivity for doing this because they were caught in price fixing. The largest vitamin companies in America were caught, like Hoffman LaRoche, and paid a fine. They were found guilty and pled guilty. As were the German companies and the Japanese company. In fact, all told, I think there were 7 in just this particular conspiracy of price fixing. But when it came to helping John Henry Thomas, after extensive conversation, I had to do the research to show what was wrong or unscientific, what was harmful about electroconvulsive therapy. And that took almost a month. I had to review every single study I could find in the world literature on electroconvulsive therapy. And what are the side effects? What are not told about it? Now, having accumulated all that data from peer-reviewed journals, and knowing when you go into a court of law, someone's going to want actual studies, not rhetoric, because the administrative judge is going to listen to both sides, and the one that is most persuasive, or the one that is held as being the most authoritative, will generally get the treatment they want, and the other one won't. So this was just one extra point on our side. But there's no one out there doing that research. Even groups that deal with electroconvulsive therapy do not have the depth of material that you would think they did have. It's just like the alternative doctors. Go to any single alternative doctor. Go to even the most profitable ones like Robert Atkins, a $100 million a year man, and ask him, do you have studies that can be cited from peer-reviewed literature showing the efficacy and safety of the therapies that you're using? What do you want to bet he didn't have those? Only a smattering of ones maybe that Jonathan Wright got or Alan Gaby got. But those wouldn't hold up as definitive. And if you don't have something definitive, people won't pay attention to you. They'll say, it's just not enough information. We need more proof. Linus Pauling, twice the winner of the Nobel Prize, he was being told that he was a quack for advocating vitamin C in very high amounts. He was suggesting for cancer a minimum of 10 to 20,000 milligrams a day. When they asked him, where's the literature to support this? There were no studies on vitamin C. He had no high doses that he knew of. What he didn't do, he didn't check the literature deeply enough, because had he done that, he would have found that a Dr. Frederick Klinner had been doing research on high levels of vitamin C for a long time on other conditions other than cancer, but at least to establish the high levels were safe and were effective for other pathologies, and therefore should be considered on that basis. Now, you'd think that as someone who ran an institute, who had won 2 Unsher Nobel Prizes, who was considered arguably one of the greatest chemists ever, would know this. And then you find out just the basics, the details. Getting the details have been overlooked. So then when you don't have facts, you better have you better have something that supports your argument. And then what generally people rely upon is partial facts and a lot of rhetoric. And as the rhetoric heats up, people stop looking at the facts. If you've got facts as a basis to create your rhetoric, then you have a chance to go forward. And so on the issues of fluoridation, if it were on rhetoric alone, long ago, we should have defluoridated every single area in the country. We haven't. And I've been at these hearings where the advocates of anti-fluoridation just don't have the depth of scholarship. And someone says, well, there's just not enough evidence here to support taking the fluoride out of the water, and the pro-fluoridationists will give you more studies. And, of course, no one's really looking carefully at their studies to show it really doesn't protect. And that's where I try to make a difference. That's why this show tries to make a difference. And we do so in a rather quiet way by putting together articles that are considered definitive. Vaccinations, definitive. Whether people listen to BAI or Pacifica, one show or another, or none of these shows, the reality is that there's a law in every single state that every child must be vaccinated. And could have up to 22 different vaccinations, and many of those vaccinations requiring multiple booster shots prior to entering first grade. My job is to help protect 280 million Americans and their children from unnecessary vaccines from a bureaucracy that is controlled completely by the pharmaceutical industry. But to show that, I have to prove it. I have to prove the conflict of interest. I have to show that ex-scientist who sat on an FDA advisory committee owns this stock or has paid this stipend or this amount of research money from this pharmaceutical company making this vaccine, and therefore that could, by extension, create a conflict of interest. Whether it's ultimately a conflict of interest will be determined by the oversight groups that either allow or disallow that. But at least the public will know, if you're going to listen to this scientist, listen to him with the understanding that they're making a direct profit when they tell you that you need this vaccine. But that alone doesn't discourage the argument. You have to go further. You have to show, all right, whether or not I want to choose to believe this this doctor is one thing, but is there any proof that the vaccine that this doctor is advocating, that he has a financial interest in, is safe and effective, or is it non-efficacious and harmful? Then you have to do all the research. Just on vaccines, just my report on vaccines on my webpage required over 5 years of research. You don't sit down in one day and get every study out of the literature and analyze it and review it and have summary conclusions in a day. If you did it every day, it's going to take you years. But what is at stake? What is at stake is sudden infant death syndrome. What's at stake is a life of autism. And you have to look at how many important issues have not been addressed. See, with Pacifica, there's 10,000 people all on it. Lawyers, law teams, advocates, demonstrations, mass mailings, campaigns, and whether or not it's always going to be resolved to the benefit of the people will, in no small measure, be determined by ultimately the facts that are presented and the court's intervention, and also what the listeners themselves choose, and not just the people who are on the air or off the air. But on vaccines, we're already in trouble. We have to undo something. With Codex, it's not on the books yet. We have to prevent it from happening. It takes research. And if you engage in the research and you get your facts and you stick with the facts and you ask others to examine those facts, they don't have to come up with the same conclusions you do. And they don't have to accept that what you're doing is what they would do. Even in the area of science, when I'm debating a doctor on an issue and taking these policies, I can challenge the doctor without ever challenging that doctor's character. And frequently, I've been in over 500 debates, and I'll be backstage talking with them. And you find they're cordial, and they're interesting people, and then suddenly, you get on television, and they take a very strong point on what they believe is right, and what you believe is wrong. And then after the show's over, you shake hands, and you realize, okay, you didn't have to demean each other in order to focus upon what you felt was right. And too often in conflicts, people try to focus on who's right rather than what is right, where the assumption is that if a person is a victim, that they perceive as being victimized by someone, then not only are they right, but the other person's automatically wrong. Therefore, they should win, the other person should lose. Change should occur for the person that is now being viewed as the victim. If that itself were what determined laws and rules of conduct, then we wouldn't be a society that is rampant with lying, cheating, stealing, self-interest, posturing, and we are. And so it's just each of us take our own method of getting stuff done. But the nice thing is that now we have laws that we're trying to pass, and that's why I'm working so hard on working with a very small group who are passing laws on mandatory vaccination, passing laws on electroconvulsive therapy, on involuntary commitment in mental institutions, on children being diagnosed as ADHD. These are all important issues. These are equally, if not more important, than the codex in many respects. Codex, someone can or cannot take their vitamins. They could certainly survive without them. There are other means, there are other methods, as people in this audience well know. But it's a freedom that we want to have. Whether we exercise it and use it or not, we want to know that if I want to buy vitamin C at 5,000 milligram, I can do so. I don't want someone telling me that I can't have my vitamin C. So we have to be aware of what's necessary in the way of scholarship, not to ascribe motive to other people that we cannot prove, to allow people to be different than us without undermining their character, to keep focused upon the issues and try to take the high road, which in this station, I'll tell you, is damn nearly as difficult as you can might mention, because the moment you do not join one group with the other, suddenly you're attacked for it. And if the audience only knew how vindictive and vicious and petty people can be when their side isn't supported, the assumption is that you're supporting the opposition. Did it ever occur to anyone that you needn't support either position of someone in power or out of power to look at the merits and demerits of both sides and to not commit yourself except to the people who are benefiting directly from the information on the airwaves? And to do that, you have to do a lot of homework. And the first rule is never take anyone's word automatically for anything. Prove for yourself what the truth is. And that doesn't come automatically. It doesn't come overnight. And I've said that many times. Same way with here, with this vitamin issue. So I'd like to continue this conversation without ascribing motives, just dealing with facts, John, because otherwise, let me tell you something. I can tell you this for a fact. A lot of people have reverted back to more base emotion and instinct by the intimidating letters and threats they've received from people around the world, assuming that if they take any position other than yours, they're the enemy. And when you've already put that information out there, then they don't want to have anything more to do with the issue, even when it's foolish and goes against the mandates. But just one example, the letter that they signed off on was not a law. It was merely their opinion and their request. It was not solidified, and it wasn't formalized as a law. And therefore, any legislator can write any oversight or governing body like the FDA, regulatory body, and give their thoughts, opinions, projections, but it doesn't mean that automatically the FDA has to do what that legislator is suggesting, because for every legislator that writes a letter wanting one thing done, another legislator can write and want the opposite done, depending upon what their perspective is. And the FDA frequently can be simply overwhelmed. Not everyone who works for the FDA is a bad person. Not everybody is there to, you know, simply support the pharmaceutical interest. I have people that communicate with me from inside the FDA, and they are hard-working civil servants. But it doesn't mean everyone is. There used to be a man at the FDA named Young, Commissioner Young, who was commissioner of the FDA. And he was one of the FDA commissioners that actually opened up the entire dialogue on what would be considered excessive efforts against vitamins. And this is when they had $1 million ad campaign going on attacking the use of vitamin supplements. It didn't do any good to attack him, but it did make sense to attack the issues and therefore allow him a chance to review how another point of view was on this. And that's exactly what I did. And I was invited down, went down and spoke with him, met with him, presented information to him, and with Senator Proxmire and Congressman Rogers, was able to get the Rogers-Proxmire Amendment passed, which was one of the important keys in the history of the vitamin supplement movement, which kept them off the back. It didn't make a convert out of Young, but it did mean that the teeth was, you know, the carnivorous teeth was yanked out of, you know, the FDA's actions at that time. Then you got another administration. You got to start all over again. Do you see what I'm saying here?
I understand fully what you're saying. One thing I'd like to say is my cousin works at the FDA. He's involved with keeping lead out of glassware like wine bottles. I see him at family gatherings. I don't hate the FDA. I also feel there are many legitimate functions which they do perform. I also recognize the fact that individuals often are indeed doing the best they can. The concern I have about this situation is that when I look at the statement made by Congressman Paul and Congressman DeFazio, who issued a statement into the record which they wanted Congressman Burton to look very closely at, they say here that according to an August 1999 report of the Congressional Research Service, as a member of the World Trade Organization, the United States does commit to act in accordance with the rules of the multilateral body. It, the United States, is legally obligated to ensure national laws do not conflict with WTO rules, unquote. Now, Congressman Paul and DeFazio say here, thus Congress may have a legal obligation to again change American laws and regulations to conform with WTO rules. And they go into a discussion of the sanitary phytosanitary measures agreement, which is something that I would like the Congressional Research Service to look at very closely in light of the fact that it requires us to enter into a constant process of harmonization. On my website, I have cited the law, and I have cited websites that people can look at that quote the law, and I would encourage people to go to IAHF.com in the What's New section under April 1st, where I have a copy of a letter that I did send to Congressman Burton asking him to please give this to the Congressional Research Service for their scrutiny.
Okay, but let's focus on this for a moment. I read the letter that you sent to Burton because you sent me a copy of it. I would have written that letter differently. I would have apologized to Beth Clay. I would have tried to mend fences there because, I'll tell you something, I've gone into film, you know, legislators, and when you're nice to people, they don't feel threatened. When you're not nice, and then you get into a whole way, and every time someone turns around, they see their name out there and being attacked, then suddenly they're not going to be friendly towards you, and they're the ones who are in a position to determine who gets invited and who doesn't. And then when you got other people saying, yeah, I was attacked too, next thing you know, almost anything that you have to say that is legitimate and is accurate will not be given the same credibility because of the method you keep using over and over and over and over and over. It's like you cannot help yourself except every day you have to go out there and attack. And these people don't like it. Apologizing and saying, hey, you know, if I said these things, it was excessive, I'd like, you know, to start over. And you know what's nice? People are very forgiving. And suddenly your information that could help a lot of people that I believe is absolutely correct. If I didn't believe your information was correct, I wouldn't have you on the show, John. So then there's a whole lot of difference between me believing information because I've independently confirmed it, been working on it myself, is important, and then getting legislators to agree that it's important. How we present that information, who presents it, how it's given to them, there are times when people have no idea this, but all the time I'm helping to get important pieces of information of a legislative nature into the process without ever mentioning my name, without ever writing a letter. I'll do the research, do the homework on it, put together the talking points, the background material, and get it into the hands of someone who is close to a power person, close to a legislator, so they can get something done where I couldn't. Maybe my name would raise some hackles, even on PBS. Even when I go on there and present very positive programming that can change lives, it doesn't mean that every station is going to say, gee, we appreciate this. No, they're going to have a doctor on their board say, Gary Nall, isn't he one of those counterculture guys who promotes unscientific nonsense about diet, disease, and lifestyle help? No, don't have him on. But if we have someone who is friendly to our cause, who is liked, and they take that same information, say, let's put this on the air. And by the way, that's how I get on the air, because every one of those doors was closed tight. Now, my latest program just 2 weeks ago was on all over the country and set records in Detroit. In fact, I did better than Doo-Wop and Lawrence Welk combined. And New York people don't see Lawrence Welk. I'll tell you something. In Heartland America, all over the country, he's extremely popular 20 years after his death. His show just keeps it. People love it. And yet we did twice that. Why? Because the people at the station bent over backwards to be nice to everyone out there. And because if you went in there with any anger, went in there with defiance, went in there accusing, that show would never get on the air. And therefore, the ultimate objective of having people change and be healthier and saving some lives would be missed. So I think that, you know, you got to appreciate just sending a letter to Burton is not the issue. It's how you word it. If you say, you know, well, I appreciate, you know, you're doing a good job on this level, but you've compromised and you've got to do this and you've got... Telling someone who's in a position of power what they've got to do is never a good idea, because people in positions of power are almost always deferred to. Offering them a humble suggestion will get you further than demanding that we demand that you do this. Now, would you agree that you've put information out there like we demand this and we demand that?
I'm seeing a letter in front of me that says, Dear Congressman Burton, thank you for stating at the oversight hearing on March 20th that you have asked the Congressional Research Services to review the Codex agreements and clarify our obligations. It is important that the Congressional Research Services be asked the right questions. Otherwise, they might not clarify anything. Please run the questions contained herein past the Congressional Research Service, and please send me their response. Since the record remains open until April 2nd on your March 20th hearing, I would like this material added to IAHF's written comments already submitted. Measures based on Codex are deemed consistent with the Sanitary Phytosanitary Measures Agreement. You must therefore ask Congressional Research Services to carefully examine the FDA's actions at Codex taken as a result of the Sanitary Phytosanitary Measures Agreement and other mutual recognition agreements, including technical barriers to trade, which our government is expected to be in conformance with. SPS, which covers all measures whose purpose is to ostensibly protect human health from foodborne risks. SBS requires standards to be based on risk assessment, and the FDA's actions, which we want the Congressional Research Service to examine carefully and to comment on, involve FDA's actions at the Codex Committee on Nutrition and Foods for Special Dietary Uses, which stem from USA's having signed the SPS agreement as part of NAFTA and GATT, including their putting the National Academy of Sciences paper titled A Risk Assessment Model for Establishing Safe Upper Levels for Nutrients on the table at the Codex meeting in Berlin over your written objection and that of Congressman Paul, DeFazio, Stump, and Cook. And then I provide information from a website that says, and this quotes the law, both NAFTA and WTO require countries to base their environmental, food safety, public health, and worker safety standards on international standards. and that's in the SPS agreement in the final act embodying the results of the Uruguay round of multinational trade negotiations, and then it gives the site, etc. So these are points of law that need to be clarified, and I cite the specific points of law that need to be clarified to help Congressman Burton and to help the Congressional Research Service so that they look at this issue in the way that it would need to be looked at in order to counter the FDA's assertion that that nothing about Codex threatens our domestic law. As specified under the FDA Modernization Act, the agency, that is the FDA, will move toward the acceptance of mutual recognition agreements relating to the regulation of good manufacturing practices between the EU and the USA. Under the FDA Modernization Act, the FDA will regularly participate in meetings with representatives of other foreign governments to discuss and reach agreement on methods and approaches to harmonize regulatory requirements. While harmonizing regulatory requirements involving our dietary supplement laws would mean to make our dietary supplement laws consistent with a finalized Codex vitamin measure. And I think that if the Congressional Research Service looks at all of this, they would then have to come to the conclusion that our sovereignty is being undermined. There are constitutional issues here which bear a very close look. And, you know, I think that, Congressman Burton made a very good opening statement. He said, "We've had a lot of complaints from citizens. They are concerned that if countries who regulate dietary supplements more restrictively than the U.S. decide to vote in bloc at Codex meetings, that our views will be overridden. Many Americans are afraid that eventually there will be restrictions placed on dietary supplement access. The FDA has stated previously that we are under no obligation to adopt Codex, but I have asked Congressional Research Service to review the Codex agreements and clarify our obligations. Many of the 165 countries that participate in the Codex look to the United States to take the lead in regulatory negotiations. We fail our citizens and the citizens of the world if we do not take a strong stand in supporting Deshae internationally. In addition to scientists, I suggest the U.S. delegation include representatives from the U.S. government who are experts in international trade negotiations, and that FDA staff and all individuals from the United States government in negotiations regarding dietary supplements negotiate from the Deshae perspective. It is important that we protect Americans' access to supplements as well as to ensure the trade barriers will not be erected that will reduce U.S. manufacturers' access to the international marketplace. Dietary supplements are an important factor in maintaining and improving health. My colleagues in Congress and I will continue to protect America's rights to access dietary supplements. The record will remain open until April 2nd. I will now recognize the ranking minority member, Mr. Waxman, for his opening statement." Now, I thanked him for that, and I also at the same time showed him the way in which the Congressional Research Service would need to look at this issue in order to really truly understand what our obligations are under SPS.